Station number 16722, Captain George Ledger, Reel 7.
Captain Ledger, Reel 7. Your first memories in France was Gondi Corps, as you've mentioned, Captain Ledger. What were you doing there?
The first things we did there was to get established with the local inhabitants and the associations with which they were concerned, and was preparing for the move to the Maginot Line, where we had to do some extensions to the Maginot Line, which was finishing on the run-up to the borders with Belgium. Of course, in those days, Belgium wouldn't allow the Maginot Line to continue up past their borders. And we were preparing to go up there to dig anti-tank bridges. That's what we did start to do.
The conditions under which you were living in Gondi Corps, were they quite good?
More or less the same as we met earlier on, in the just line and halls and floors and such like. We never had any, we were just using straw palliasses and such like. We never had any good billets to call beds. I can't remember ever sleeping in a bed in France. Just on a straw mattress, a palliasse.
You mentioned the girls that you would be obviously friendly with, but the rest of the population in this area of France, did they treat you well?
Oh, I did. I found them very well, yes. I didn't find anyone. There was never in my case, or any case I remember, of any of the regiment was any animosity about them. On occasions, you used to hear some reports coming through to the battalion headquarters, and such a fella from another different company had been brought up by CO about some triviality, or at least might not have been trivial, but some happening or incident with another person in another regiment, another unit. And it used to come through battalion orders, such and such has been sort of punished for doing these sort of things. But it was rather difficult to pinpoint anybody who caused that.
Relaxing again, what did you do for relaxation?
This is down in
Gondi Corps.
In Gondi Corps, across in Gondi Corps. Well, the only occasion relaxation was going to cafes. And we used to go nearly every night to a cafe in France, and the favourite thing was chips and egg and chips. And we had one officer who was he was very, very friendly towards all of them. I think he was out of place at times. He was too friendly, and he got himself talked about as being too friendly with the troops. You know, I won't mention his name, but he used to come down regular and just put his nose in the coffee where the lads were, and he used to, oh, I'll pay for those, and just get the fish and the egg and chips, and it's my turn to get this round. And not that I was being familiar in a sense, as I realised, you know, not to say familiarity breeds contempt, but not in that manner. But he thought he was being sociable, but I think it was against his own ideals, you know. He wasn't doing himself a favour by letting his other officers see him do this, because officers had a certain position to keep, and there had to be a distance between them. But this one, who was very, very friendly, and we, with the troops, naturally, all the troops rather spoke well of him.
So he settled back, or was dragged back into a keep a distance situation?
Yes. There was a... There was that position always obtained during the whole time I was in the war. There was always difference between officers and other ranks. I mean, there hadn't to be too much familiarity, otherwise discipline would go, it would just go through the flow. I would say anyway, there had to be that difference. But having said that, it wasn't a case of being unfair with any of the other ranks, or the other ranks being unfair with the officers who were knew, felt they were it was too aloof or something like that, for the want of a better word. But the other ranks, well, we knew people who were in a higher position had a job to do and had to maintain that position, had to get the work done properly.
There was no envy then between the other ranks of the officers, because the officers seemed to have the best billets, the best food.
Well,
best transport.
They did have, but you must must realise the officers had to pay for everything. The other ranks had everything paid for them. It was most noticeable to me when we were crossing Egypt. I mean, I'm not to Egypt yet, but an officer in Cairo, for instance, could get a five course meal for five shillings, you know. But for five piastres, another rank could get a good meal for five piastres, and they had all free entertainment, and they had all, well, at that much time, I turned the bevy of beautiful girls around, all different continents, you know, they had the pick. So there wasn't a lot difference, really, in the living standards of the officers. The officers had to pay for what they got, and the other ranks was paid for them. All the other ranks had to do was to enjoy themselves and make sure they enjoyed the facilities which were on offer. And they certainly made that.
How did the men, early times in France, how did the men take to the local beverages and drinks?
Well, rather not knowledgeable at all about them, actually. With the result that naturally they had the come downs, the fall downs, and they got the comeuppance when they used to say, oh, I can drink all that, and drink that stuff. And when they really got down to it, they just couldn't. And there was more cases of drunkenness until such time as they got used with the different types of spirits. It was mainly wine and such like which sent them crackers. Spirits and things they could adapt to, they knew what spirits were, but wines. And these were rather funny things across in France, because there's different volumes and, alcoholic volumes in wines. And they weren't used, because they all bottle of wine, that's great, we'll go into a bottle of wine. Before they knew where they were, the evening was spoiled. Until such time, I mean, it took a long while for them to realise.
Did they get close to the young French ladies, as they had been in England?
Well, I wouldn't imagine so. I think the French girls used to keep themselves sort of in check, for the want of explanation better. But I think the French girls used to keep themselves in check. The type which could keep themselves in check, all countries is girls and girls. I mean, there's a type who are out for a good time. And they're the ones who seem to worry the British troops a lot. And I think it came to such a time that, they had to create places for the troops to go to have treatment. And such like.
These are VD centres?
VD centres. And the work places fixed up where troops could go in and get some preventatives, and after the being with the French girls, they could go and have treatment and be issued with stuff to clean themselves with.
Was it an offence to catch VD?
Well, I wouldn't say, I couldn't say whether it was officially an offence to catch VD, but there were a lot of it happened. I became aware of it mainly after I'd been commissioned in Egypt, not in front, but I became aware of it in Egypt when I was commissioned, and I used to do these regular daily officers' routine examination.
We'll come to that shortly,
once in time.
Training, were you doing any training in Gondokoro?
The training we did was really just very, very little as such training, because all our energies was used up on the digging these anti-tank ditches, and we were really working there. There were massive things we were digging.
So what time in the day would you set off to do this task?
Oh, early in the morning, and we'd be there all day.
You're there all day?
Yes. Mm.
Can you describe to me what the ditch was like and how it was being done?
The ditch, it would be approximately, this is just approximate, sitting now 50 odd years, but the ditch would be approximately 10 to 12 feet high. And then it used to be straight up, and it would be all revetted out with bamboo revetments that prevented coming in, and supported by posts. The material which was taken out of it was thrown on the front side and sloped down like that at an angle, which that when a tank came up, the nose of the tank was pointing up when it got to the ditch, so that any of the troops at this side could fire underneath the nose of the tank. You know, that was the...
Into the belly.
That was, yes, into the belly of the tank. That's the front side. When if you first meet it, it's like that. It went up like that. You come along here, and it went up like that. And there was the belly of the tank over there. And you could, from that side, you could fire up into it. But down, straight down there, that was straight down. And then there was a flat bottom where you used to walk along. And it came up gradually that way. Back to it, and then you could walk out of that side. But it was so high that when the tank did get across, it just couldn't get back. I mean, it would just topple over. But all that work was done for nothing, because it just never used it. It just came around the corner.
Was it a matter of pride as to the quality of the digging?
It had to be straight lines, miles and miles straight lines. And a little bit of revetment out there had to be, and everybody took pride in whose share was better than the others. Well, it was just a case of, not a case of discipline or forcing people to do it correctly. It was just they decided that theirs had to look better than the other. But eventually it had to be that it had to be all the same. And if anything was sticking out a bit, had the lines along, and that had to be put right.
Was there any concrete pillboxes built into the defensive system?
Well, as the DLI were concerned, we didn't build any concrete. There were concrete defences, but we didn't build any. That was left to the other services who dealt with that sort of thing. We only dealt with, as miners, digging, because we were all diggers, and we were given that sort of job. In some cases, when we were digging the trenches, I used to get a lot of jobs putting the roofs on them because I was a joiner. I used to put wood trusses across and put corrugated sheeting across and cover it over with soil and then grass to hide the trench, you know, things like that.
And were they pretty shell-proof, these covers that you put on the trenches?
No. They were just a camouflage. They were not shell-proof at all. The last one I ever did like that was around Nicosia Airport, and I'm not there yet.
The trenches that you were, you mentioned the deep trench.
The anti-tank ditches.
But the other trenches that you were digging in France, were they on the lines of the First World War, the continuance things, or just...?
They weren't in straight lines. We didn't have a lot. We didn't fight a lot in trenches. I can't remember the daylight ever fighting in trenches in France. We always fought on top of the ground, going across and just lying down and firing into a ditch, which is the side of a hedge. We didn't have time to start digging trenches. At odd times when we were in reserve, we used to dig shallow holes just for us to lie in to stop any shrapnel from airplanes, you know, catching you when you were lying down in the... But very, very rare that we had any trenches to fight. I can't remember fighting from a trench in France. We were all up on our feet and running across country.
You were a sergeant, you say, by now?
By then I was a sergeant, yeah.
Were you getting any talks, lectures on your enemies, what they might be like and how you might deal with them?
Well, we had lectures like that long before I was a sergeant. Sergeants actually were taught this, and the sergeants used to give us lectures when it was passed down. Yes, we were given a lot of lectures on what the enemy were like. In fact, we were issued with a lot of pamphlets on this subject. And they were very, very good. They were really up to date, the type of enemy we were facing. And they were well equipped. The information we were given in the pamphlets showed that the Germans were really well equipped, and we had a formidable foe in front of us.
Did it strike you that you were not quite as well equipped?
It struck us vividly, because we just went across there with a pitchfork for the sake of a better word. All we went across there with at the beginning of the war was a rifle with a bin on the end, a 2-inch mortar, a .5 anti-tank gun, and that was it.
The Brenz?
The Brenz. The 303 Brenz. That's all. We weren't a match for some of the equipment which the Germans had when they eventually arrived on the job. We used to think, in first we didn't used to think about it actually, because we didn't know any other. We thought that was it, that's what we had to fight with. Until eventually when the war really got started and fighting started taking place, and various reports came with the equipment that the other side were using, that we started to get something similar. And then we used to bleat a bit.
This was the time of the phony war, was it not?
Yes.
You were there quite a while and nothing was happening.
There was not a thing happening. Yet.
Did you see anything? Was there any aerial activity going on? Were there any scares?
When we went across there, it was very, very active. When we went across there, until not the Germans, that was active and preparing for the Germans coming. When I say digging trenches, it's just like a hive of activity. There's a lot of movement, transport, and just like going. But eventually, when the phony war ended, and the Germans really said too, we were just overrun with the French people. We just couldn't get on with our work. We couldn't travel on the roads.
Yeah, but we'll come to that. Yeah. As I say, 50th Division was a mobile division. Were you getting any training getting onto wagons and off wagons?
We did, yes. That was one of the regular features we had in the 50th Division. Debussing and ambushing on the trucks. I can't quite remember how many men we used to put in each truck at the moment. But we used to try and sort of vie with each other, put one platoon, see who could do it the quickest. And that's how a lot of the envy came in, the not animosity, but the keenness to do better than the other side. There was always that effect. One platoon was always trying to do better than another one. Oh, you're just not platoon. That's no good. You want to get in a proper platoon. And this is a thing like that. Well, it created a lot of heated discussion, but a lot of happiness and all, because it engendered jokes. It was people just laugh at, you know. It was great.
As a sergeant, were you brought more into the picture of what was expected of you and your platoon and so on?
Well, I found a great difference, Harry, from being a corporal. I mean, naturally, from a corporal, a lance corporal, in my case, it was rather quick. I was promoted Lance Corporal at the outset of war, as soon as I was called up. And shortly after I was promoted Corporal. So there wasn't a great distinction between me and private and a corporal, you know. But there was the difference between a corporal and a sergeant until such time as I became a sergeant. Oh, a sergeant to me was a massive man, great authority he had. And he used to be in awe of them when war first started. Because let's face it, we were just territorial soldiers, you know, and sergeants in those days were sergeants, you know. But eventually, when I really was promoted as a sergeant, I realised I was promoted as a Lance Sergeant first. Then automatically, after a certain period, I became a full sergeant, which was an automatic promotion. But I found that the difference between a sergeant and a Lance Corporal was such that you were on a par with a Sergeant Major in the RSM, as opposed to the officer and his other ranks. See the difference between an officer and other ranks, and a sergeant and a corporal. See the two differences. We're on a part with those two differences. It's rather a funny way to explain it, but that's the way I felt. But when I became a sergeant, I was given so much information, not all at once, but it trickled through in a proper manner. It just didn't trickle through in a haphazard manner. It trickled through properly because the people above me knew what they were doing. They did it with every sergeant, naturally. It was the way the army went. The information was trickled through in a manner that made the sergeants not forget it. They didn't give them too much at once, but the information was always there, and eventually it all came through in such time as I had to be able to use it. And then when they found out the man was able to use it properly, because there was lots of power given to a sergeant, you know. A lot of people didn't realise. They had to keep a lot themselves.
Were you taught or trained to, in effect, take over your platoon if anything happened to your officers? Were you able to do this?
Yes. We were given information. Mainly through in a backhand manner, by being informed of how the officer had to run us. We were taught how the officer had to look after us, you know, as sergeant. With the results that when the officer wasn't there, we had to continue to run the platoon as the officer had done, which was a must, because in those days, beginning of the war, our officers used to be second lieutenants. In the beginning of the war, when we went into action, there was more second lieutenants got killed because the fighting was different. The officer always seemed to lead from the front, the second lieutenant, when we went into action. He was always in the front, and he was getting killed too often. Instead of being behind his platoon, directing them where I say they should be, not in the front, I say they should be behind, directing, and they can direct from behind. And that's where I think they made a big mistake until such times they realised that officers, that's where they had to be, not up there in the front. They had to be at the back and direct them, but to guard them. You can lead people from the back just as easy as you can lead them from the front. That's the way I feel about it.
Are you saying then that the enemy was in effect looking to hit the officer?
Well, this was the natural thing to do, because the Germans would know. I mean, this was a fact in the British Army that the person who led the platoon was an officer in the front. So that was the first man. If you get that man out the road, then it was a help towards breaking down the consolidation the platoon could make without him.
Where would the sergeant be in an active situation like that?
When it first started, the officer was in front and the sergeant was at the back. He was directing the platoons, the three sections he was in charge of, because there was three sections in the platoon, and the sergeant was in the back, not in the front, not that he was hiding, but that's where his place was. And he could direct better from the front, because it seemed more, let's face it, when you're just talking about 30 men, you can talk 30 men from the back just as well as you can from the front. I mean, to turn and when you're advanced from the front, you have to turn around and say, right, look, you go there, you go there, you go there. And when you turn around and looking at him, you're not seeing what's happening up there. And things happen in a second when there's bullets and things flying around, you know. So you've got to have your eyes ahead of you. And that's where the value to me is, where the sergeant's at the back, although he's at the back, and still see right with the front, and I still see that's where the officer should be, directing from the back of the platoon. And that's my opinion. And I think there wouldn't have been so many second lieutenants killed as that day.
What was the usual way of moving the sections into an attacking or assaulting situation?
Well, a lot depended, Harry, on the land itself. You had to take in consideration hedges, ditches, undulations in the ground, and the matter of the way trees and such like could affect any advance you were going to make. I mean, for instance, if you were going to make an advance up there and there was a big copse there, you wouldn't send them out in open order. You'd put them in single file, get round the copse, and then extend out afterwards. Things like that have to be considered. But you had to use your intelligence by reading the land properly. You just cannot say, go there and go there and go there, without reading that land where you're sending them to. You've got to understand that when you send somebody there, you've got to realise he needs somewhere where he can hide or save himself if he's fired on. I mean, I couldn't say to you, how do you go up there, look? Nice, lovely lawn up there, you can walk up there. You go up there and set a position up there. I wouldn't do that, because if you go up there walking there, you haven't got any cover at all. You're open, you could be mowed down in the thing. So the sergeant and officer had to think about these things. They had to think about the person's manner of being covered from the enemy, or by his own people from the enemy, before he sent them out there. They had to think about the safety all the time.
Was it usually in the lifespan of a sergeant with his platoons that you were pretty constant, but the officers would be changing?
Well, we had a lot in the first end of the war breaking out. There was such a lot of officers training, changing, because there was such a lot of building to do. The units were getting larger. There was more units to be made. So officers who had been trained were getting moved to less trained places so that they can pass on their information to the newly trained units. So some of them didn't stay with you very long, you know. And some of them also managed to be quite a good while, but they had that facility of moving them to give their experience and their learning and the training to the new units coming up. That's the reason.
There must have been many times, though, when the sergeant was the most experienced man and would need to assist a young officer. Is this true?
It's very, very true. Now, this is not saying anything against the new officer. I say that without fear of contradiction, because I've had the experience myself. It's very, very true that the experience of sergeants, because a sergeant doesn't get to the rank of sergeant before he's been through the rank of a private, a lance corporal and a corporal. And he's got the experience of living and saving himself in uncertain positions and being alive to do it. He's got to have the experience which has been passed on to him by his elders. And we realised, as sergeants, I mean, in my case, I realised as a corporal, because I'd been promoted quickly. And it came to me when the war first broke out and all these new officers were coming. We were getting a lot of young officers, very, very young officers, who had just been bank tellers, bank workers, you know, mainly, you know, a lot of them. And people in that category who had some means, financial means, for to be covered for to pay for his costs of being an officer, to buy all his equipment, which wasn't available to the impoverished person, you know, people who were less financially well off. But money had a lot to do with it. But having said that, once you got those people in there, and they got taught and they understood the position. Some of the finest officers I ever came across was from bank tellers and such like in the banks. There were some of the finest officers I ever came across was the same type of people I've been talking about, who just came from, we say we just came from money folks, but they came from money folks, but at the same time, how did they manage to get the money? They learned, worked hard to get that money, so therefore they had the brains to learn, work hard to be an officer in the army. That's how it was sorted out.
But essentially the relationship between the sergeant and the officer must have been a vital one.
Vital, yes. It had to be one of trust and confidence. You had to trust the manner in which the sergeant was able to control his sections, and the sergeant had to trust his officer that he was able to pass the messages down from his company commander and the major in charge of the battalion to pass the information down through him to get through to his privates to get the job done.